Sick Enough, Chapter 21, Substance Abuse Disorder. Case Shelley. Shelley is a 32-year-old, cisgender, Caucasian female who has struggled with anorexia nervosa, purging subtype, and substance abuse for years. Her parents remember her as a feisty, daring little girl who loved to put on performances for anyone who would watch. They also recollect that she constantly seemed to be in conflict with one or more of her friends at any given time. Popular and charismatic, she was always extremely sensitive. Her bewildered parents would frequently observe their stormy daughter returning home from school in floods of tears because of an argument or perceived insult from one of her friends. They would try to comfort her with variable success. They watched Shelley's struggle to self-soothe and have a hard time distinguishing between big conflicts and small conflicts. All affected her strongly, equally strongly. Shelley remembers her childhood mostly fondly, but always felt her parents didn't understand her and never showed up for her the way she needed them to. She started drinking and smoking cigarettes with her friends at age 13, and she started smoking pot when she was 14. She had sex for the first time while high that same year. Shelley's eating disorder started when she was 15, when she started a diet along with her group of friends. Her determination to be the best at whatever she did drove her to restrict harder than the others. However, she was so famished that she started to binge. Deciding this was unacceptable, she soon started to purge after her binges. She flew under the radar, seeming like a successful, popular, thin, beautiful young woman throughout high school. In college, Shelley would often restrict calories all day in order to go out partying with her sorority sisters at night and not worry about the calories. Her enjoyment of college and constant social support started to stabilize her eating disorder behaviors. However, she started using cocaine regularly. She didn't feel concerned as her grades were fine and she was using less cocaine than many of her peers. After graduation from college, Shelley crashed, suddenly on her own and facing expectations that she get a job. She felt isolated and overwhelmed at the prospect of the adult life ahead of her. Shelley responded by diving into restriction, purging, and alcohol. Over the next few years, her parents supported her through various substance use and eating disorder treatment programs. However, she was never fully abstinent either from substances or from her eating disorder while in programming. As time went on, she increasingly left treatment against medical advice. Shelley stabilized somewhat in her late 20s. A friend's death then sent her into a full-blown relapse in order to numb the pain of her grief. Now drinking heavily, intermittently using cocaine, underweight and with several emergency department visits for passing out and abnormal electrolytes, Shelley realizes she needs more definitive help. Background. Eating disorders and substance use disorders co-occur with a remarkably high frequency. Up to half of patients with eating disorders abuse drugs or alcohol. In patients with substance use disorder, more than 35% also report an eating disorder. We know that this is vastly higher than the 1 to 4% of eating disorders in the general population. In adolescents with eating disordered behaviors, rates of substance use and abuse are 20 to 40% higher than peers without eating disorders. A large study of women with anorexia nervosa subdivided patients into different behavior groups, including a group with restrictive anorexia nervosa called RAN, R-A-N, and a group with lifetime history of anorexia nervosa and bulimia nervosa, called ANBN. Among the whole sample, 20% met criteria for a lifetime history of alcohol abuse or dependence. The prevalence was highest in the ANBN group at 35% and lowest in the RAN, RAN group at 13.7%. The risk of drug abuse or dependence was 6.25 times higher in the ANBN group, with a prevalence of 32% compared with the RAN group. Cannabis was the most commonly used drug overall. However, patients with ANBN were also 6.55 times more likely to use stimulants, 5.89 times more likely to use cocaine, and 4.72 times more likely to use sedatives than patients with RAN. Patients in the group who ever purged were 1.83 times more likely to abuse alcohol and 3.79 times more likely to abuse drugs than patients who purely restricted. Another study followed patients over 10 years who had been hospitalized for their anorexia nervosa. It found that patients who reported binge eating while underweight were 6 times likelier to have substance use disorder than those who purely restricted. The risk was also associated with a higher incidence of alcohol use disorder among first-degree relatives. In any purging behaviors, we're more likely to smoke cigarettes. In addition, women with an eating disorder, particularly if they engaged in any purging behaviors, were more likely to smoke cigarettes and smoked more frequently to control weight than healthy controls. Patients who restrict calories or purge to avoid weight gain from drinking alcohol are said to have drunkorexia, an informal term that nonetheless captures the spirit of the problem. A study showed that individuals engaging in drunkorexia are a risk for future formal diagnosis of eating and substance use disorders. Food is not an addiction. Does this mean that we should regard eating disorders as food or starvation addictions, and by extension, that these patients are simply at higher risk for other addictions? Absolutely not. I firmly reject the proposition that food or sugar addiction exists. The notion of sugar addiction is another example of modern-day pseudoscience. A study extensively reviewed the literature and neuroscience on so-called processed food and sugar addiction in animals and humans. It found little evidence to support sugar addiction in humans. In animals, addiction-like behaviors, such as binging, only occurred when animals had intermittent rather than routine access to sugar. Once again, we find that restriction causes binging, not the palatability of the food itself. If a person deprives themselves of sufficient food or a certain type of food, aka being on a diet, they set up cravings and are more likely to binge. By contrast, consistent, moderate consumption of unrestricted foods doesn't set the deprivation binge pendulum in motion. Another study reframed the concept of food addiction as an unnecessary medicalization, identifying that our basic reward system for eating or even overeating food shouldn't be pathologized as a disease. Why do eating disorders and substance abuse co-occur? What are the reasons for this high rate of comorbidity between eating disorders and substance abuse disorders? Most agree that a biopsychosocial model best fits this program. Biological features like inherited risk for addiction or temperamental traits, personality factors like impulsivity, novelty seeking, and mood dysregulation, comorbid psychological illness, and environmental exposures all play a part. One study demonstrated perhaps not surprisingly, that patients with BED and comorbid mood disorders, personality disorder features, and substance use disorder had more severe eating disorder symptoms. Alcohol and drugs can play three key roles for patients with eating disorders. One, alcohol and drugs satisfy the novelty seeker's quest to have a good time. Two, using substances can serve as self-medication. If an individual is anxious, depressed, overwhelmed, or has other psychiatric diagnoses like bipolar disorder that haven't been adequately addressed by medications, alcohol and drugs can provide welcome relief or at least an escape. Three, some substances carry the side effect of weight loss, ranging from legal to illegal, tobacco, caffeine, cocaine, heroin, and amphetamines all can be used to suppress appetite and body weight. Given that alcohol and drugs serve clear purposes for patients, it is important to remember that sobriety work must offer ways to satisfy or redirect these needs in other ways. Outcomes and treatment. Despite the impact that substance use disorder has on health and lives, only 6% of individuals with substance use disorder seek treatment. Among this minutely small proportion, over half never complete treatment. In patients with eating disorders, substance abuse results in worse outcomes than those with eating disorders alone. Similarly, those with substance use disorders who also have an eating disorder show more severe substance abuse and worse functional outcomes. These comorbid diagnoses contribute to increased medical complications, worse psychopathology, longer time to recover, and higher relapse rates. One of the challenges patients with comorbid eating disorders and substance use disorder face is the high prevalence of early treatment termination. While reasons may range from inability to tolerate a sober and nourished life to frustration with care systems that are often inadequate for managing both conditions, studies have shown that individuals with both diagnoses have a much higher rate of stopping treatment. One study of patients in a residential substance use facility found that about 7% of patients likely had an eating disorder, and about 65% of patients likely had an alcohol use disorder. 17% of patients left against medical advice. A regression analysis controlled for age, years of education, depression symptoms, alcohol use, and drug abuse. It found that eating disorder symptoms were significantly associated with the decision to leave treatment against medical advice. Similarly, in a study of young adult men in residential substance use treatment who were assessed for binge, purge, and binge eating symptoms, treatment rejection was associated with eating disorder symptoms after controlling for a multiple of factors. The authors concluded that impulsivity, distress intolerance, and challenges with emotional regulation were particularly high among the men with disordered eating symptoms. Treatment for patients with comorbid eating disorders and substance use disorder should take place in settings that have expertise in both. For instance, when patients enter substance use treatment, their eating disorder symptoms may spiral out of control as they confront sobriety. Many substance use programs simply lack the staffing and protocols to help create appropriate meal plans, observe patients at the table, monitor bathrooms for purging, and therapeutically support eating disorder recovery. Similarly, many patients who enter day treatment for eating disorder symptoms find their substance abuse escalating. As one numbing strategy is taken away, the patient can be inexorably drawn to the other. My clinical expertise is that top residential eating disorder programs are probably best for those with comorbid substance use disorders. These programs can consistently nourish and support patients through their eating disorder. While by virtue of being residential, they are also oases for sobriety. However, if patients' drug or alcohol abuse is severe enough, they may need to start their treatment in a medical hospital for detoxification. Ideally, this would occur in a medical hospital with eating disorder expertise so that no time is wasted. Detoxing someone from heroin or alcohol for a week while they are still restricting food or purging in the hospital doesn't prepare them sufficiently to enter a mental health residential program. Case resolution. Shelley. Shelley's readiness to change prompts her parents to call a highly regarded residential eating disorder program. During the intake, the program recommends that Shelley start her recovery work at a specialized medical hospital that can oversee detoxification from alcohol as well as begin nutritional rehabilitation. Shelley admits to the medical hospital with a high blood alcohol level, noting that she had a last hurrah en route to the hospital. The first week of hospitalization is a challenge. Her alcohol withdrawal is severe, requiring intensive monitoring and medical management. Getting her to eat is hard while she withdraws from alcohol, and she accepts a nasogenol NG tube to get through this stage. By the time she emerges from the hospital, Shelley is fully detoxified from alcohol, has gained a few pounds, and is tolerating a high-caloric nutritional rehabilitation meal plan by mouth. She feels vastly better. She feels so much better, in fact, that it's hard to convince her to proceed as planned to the residential eating disorder program. She is convinced that she's fine and will be able to sustain this at home. Only with intensive family support and the hospital's team's efforts does she agree to try admission to the eating disorder program. Over the next 8 weeks in residential, with a nourished, sober brain, Shelley makes therapeutic progress that had always eluded her in the past. When it comes time to transition to day treatment, she again resists because she feels so confident that she can manage on her own. Once again, her family and team convince her to give it a go. Within the first week, she gets drunk with her roommate in the program's apartment. This serves as a wake-up call, and she redoubles her efforts in treatment. By the time she leaves the program several months later, having completed all levels of available care, she has a great team in place, plans to attend AA meetings, and knows not to discount the power of her substance use disorder or her eating disorder. That concludes the reading of Sick Enough, Chapter 21, Substance Use Disorder.